Hi, Internet. My name is Jonathan Matos.
And this is Melissa Matos.
Welcome to Unboxing Story, where we unpack fiction without the friction. We also both write things.
Yes.
The author of Cain and Abel, Spade, spelled Spade?
Spade?
Spade, I knew you were going to pass.
No.
Spelled K-C-A-N-E-A-B-L-E.
There's no K, just C-A-N-E and A-B-L-E.
For you and me. And,
You can get it on Kindle now.
Yes. Oh, you can get it on Kindle Unlimited. And you can also get it on Audible for free if you don't have an Audible account already. Sign up for that and you could get it and download it and listen to it and love it all for no money. You are the author of?
I am the author of The Iron Sorcerer and soon to be coming in spring 2021, Song of the Wild. Go to my website and sign up for updates. I spent a lot of time in the past week and a half.
This is a book clapping for
trying to get my website presentable, which I believe it is now. So go to momtoast.com, sign up for the Introvert Illuminati, which is my newsletter, and get all the knows about the stuff.
Month was a we trended toward the I always trend toward the dark, but we trended towards a couple thrillers because there were a couple, I guess you could say, high profile thrillers that we were both interested in seeing.
It's kind of scary movie time, isn't it? It's like after the Oscars, so they put out all the cheapy horror movies.
Oh right, I forgot that
time of the year.
Yeah. That January and February seems to be when they dump some of the, like, indie lower budget.
Stuff they don't want anybody else to remember.
Yeah, and so what's funny about that is that sometimes
you get some good stuff.
Some great stuff, because people are just like, I don't know how to market this. Put it out and hope people ignore it. And then everybody's like, but we like that.
Yeah, but that was good.
Nobody went to see that doesn't live in, like, a major city. But one of those is Invisible Man. Being somebody that grew up with the classic, and having that be one of the first, like, gothic horror novels that I really, enjoyed, I was looking forward to it because it seemed like they really liked it, like, in the sense that, like, it wasn't just a part of the, so, you know, we went through the whole Dark Universe thing where they were trying to do superhero shared universe style monster movies and have them cross over. So
yes.
You had The Mummy.
Which theoretically should have worked, and I don't understand quite why it didn't, except that they apparently did not understand
so
their subject matter.
What was weird was that apparently they did, I kind of said this before, but in privately with Melissa, but like they did American Werewolf in London with The Mummy. Why?
Yeah, I don't know.
Who knows? Because it's a weird thing to take that and try to make it a werewolf story. And, like, they already, like, The Mummy, the original Mummy movie, they already took an Egyptian myth and made it gothic.
Yeah.
So I don't know why they just changed it to be, like, it was an infection so that it follows Tom Cruise around globetrotting, like, Europe.
Yeah, no.
It's a weird thing. So
get it.
Anyway,
we should
they
do it.
Tried that, and they tried to introduce.
We should have a talk sometime about the classic monsters and what they represent.
Oh yeah, no, that would be fun because we talked a little bit about it when we did the Heckle and John.
Jekyll and Hyde.
My mind discombobulated now because I was already
sorry. I interrupted. I thought on it.
But no, we had talked about that when we did the Abbott and Costello meet.
Yes, Frankenstein.
Frankenstein, right. And because a lot of them are in that same movie. And so if you want initial thoughts on that, we can do that. But I'm a fan of those.
Yeah.
Fan of Dracula, fan of
Invisible Man. I think each of those represents a very important archetype in storytelling. So
mm-hmm.
It would be an interesting thing to see.
Right. But they tried to do a shared universe, didn't really work. They had done a standalone Dracula movie already, that didn't really work. So people going into this, regardless of like what company owned the properties at what time, and like Wolfman, I think was not even the same company, but like there was a, like that, the stench of those movies was like making people think, oh, it's another reinvention of a monster thing. But it's a really original idea. It's with Elizabeth Moss from Handmaid's Tale.
As, it was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
She's my new favorite crazy person.
As the victim of a really...
Basically gaslighting.
Yeah, a really terrible long-term abuse in a relationship where she was not... was severely manipulated and with physical and emotional abuse to not leave this like estate on the riverside, and is, you know, leaves, escapes that with the help of her sister, and then is convinced by this she's trying to deprogram herself, trying to like get the will to go outside, and finds out that supposedly the person that was keeping her captive is dead. But then all of a sudden, oopsie, there's something that's following her, and it's a very good at making you think, well, is she crazy?
Right.
You know, being very psychological with how the camera is placed and everything.
Yeah, I loved the panning shots of nobody, because you can't see the guy. But, like, you know something that they're trying to portray that someone is there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exciting. Everybody's, like, staring at the screen, like, did you see something move? Is there a shadow? Like, what's going on?
And I was so glad that we got so many people in the audience, because you could hear the tension. And even if there were people laughing... Like, you could tell it was nervous laughter because everybody's, like, on the edge of their seat waiting for something to happen. And there were times when I was, like, holding my fingers in my ears, because I know most of the time these movies, like, have, you know...
Really loud stingers.
Really loud stingers, so I'm, like, waiting. My girlfriend is notorious for jumping 5 feet in the air. At any jump scare, so
there were several, like, false ones in this
movie. I was holding myself and holding her. I think, like, we got this, baby. Like, we're good. But I was pleased with what they did with it. There were some nerdy Easter eggs for fans of the original novel. Mm-hmm. They had a mannequin in the one girl's room that had a fedora and coat on.
And they had the one guy all bandaged up at the hospital, just like the way that you would, you know, used to bandage up the guy. It was pretty good.
Right.
Oh, and shout out to, and I never remember his name, which is terrible, the guy that played Hardison in Leverage.
Oh, right, right.
Because he did a very good job as well in the whole thing.
Yeah, that's one of Melissa's favorite.
I love that guy.
Shows, and that's my favorite character in that show. So I was glad that actor got to exercise his chops.
There you go. I want a t-shirt that says Age of the Geek, baby.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, because that, actually, I didn't know, like, that Matt back in the day introduced me to that show, and that was one of his favorite things, because we were comic nerds together, right? And so that phrase was something that he felt like was a cool thing to describe, you know, the renaissance of nerd culture. And Knives Out was another one we were hoping to catch. As somebody who recently admitted to himself that he's a mystery writer, I thought it was cool that the guy, Rian Johnson, the guy behind the most controversial movie in the past decade, The Last Jedi, was able to do something that was just very fun and crowd pleasing, and that
was it was very what's her name? Agatha Christie. Very Agatha Christie feeling.
Mm-hmm.
With more of a twisted sense of humor.
Right. Yeah. Cause that's the thing, is that I'm the type of person that, like, when I was growing up with stuff in the '90s, that was very cynical, like Scream. One of the jokes in that is that one of the characters has seen all of the horror movies.
Right.
And so it's kind of like, it thinks that it's a smart movie in the sense, Scream is. It thinks that it's smart because it recognizes some of the tropes from slasher movies. But when you're watching it, like, there's really not very much to chew on. It's just another one of those movies. It might say that it is one of those movies, but that doesn't make it smart for recognizing that, right? Knives Out was a very good story in itself. And it also recognized a lot of the tropes that happen within mystery movies, right?
But I think my favorite thing is the chick that puked every time she lied, because that just made things so much more interesting.
That was a very funny thing
to throw in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's...
And Daniel Craig talking with a Southern accent, because...
Oh, right.
That was just hilarious.
Yeah, and that was another thing. It was very quirky.
Yeah.
But they were inventive quirks that, like you were saying, like with the puking every time she lied thing. Like, that was a very good character revelation for her that, like, oh, like, that's the type of... I know that type of person. So that was cool. And I liked... I also liked the fact that it was about a rich family's money, but I wasn't like, they did a good job, kind of like Parasite did, of showing rich people and taking different moments to humanize them.
Yeah.
So that, like, you could tell that I'm not supposed to like these people. They're very antagonizing, but they're not cartoonish villains. Where they're uninteresting to watch. Like, I was consistently... That's the whole thing with a whodunit. You don't want to know who the bad guy is the first 5 minutes.
Right.
So it was consistently interesting to kind of figure out where, you know, what's this guy doing? Do I really trust him? Like, for example, there's the part where Michael Shannon is cornering the protagonist.
Oh, right.
And up until that point, you were kind of, like, on the fence about him.
Yeah.
And then in that moment, you're like, oh, like, that... starts getting unsettling.
Right. And I liked how they played with the different versions of what people told happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, they would show it to you from one person's point of view,
uh-huh.
and then they would show it to you from someone else's point of view, and how drastically that changed your point of view about things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how the one person was like, oh, yeah, you know, we included her in all our conversations, and it looks like they're, like, inviting her over to celebrate with whatever party they were having.
Uh-huh.
And then... You hear it from her side, and there's, like, they were having an argument about immigration, and they asked me to come over to, like, make a comment on it.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay.
Yeah.
This family's messed up. It was really brilliant the way I like how when people play that way with points of view.
Right. Yeah, and that was an interesting thing, was that it did it for plot purposes, because there were things that you didn't catch that they then, just by changing something slightly or... based on the perspective, it would show it again, and you're like, oh, that's what's actually happening.
Yeah.
It would do that for plot purposes, but, like, as I was saying before, like, it would do that for character revelation things.
Right.
Because you would see, oh, that what you thought from this perspective was one way is actually another. But yeah, so I thought it was definitely a good thing. Like, I'm pretty sure that it premiered, it was in theaters for a limited time, but... also premiered on Netflix.
Oh.
But regardless, it's on Netflix if you guys want to check it out. Because I think AMC has this thing now where they're, I forget what they call it.
Well, we didn't see it on Netflix. Did I mess up? I watched it on Amazon.
Oh, I might be getting that wrong. It might just be
on
Amazon.
But it's one of those streamy things.
Yeah, it might be on Amazon. It might have been on Amazon Prime at the same time as the theater. But yeah, there's an AMC thing where they're doing films. Oh, Artisan is what they're calling it. And it's interesting because what that sounds like is muffin movies.
Yes.
But let me explain muffin movies.
Muffin movies.
So, being in Philadelphia, we do have a indie film like scene. There are a couple theaters downtown that will do art house movies, but the way that we joke about how, you know, there's only people that in the financial district that get to see these movies is the fact that they have muffins.
Yeah, and in they have a bakery at their concession. And bran muffins and like all these, but they don't have nachos.
Right.
Which is a sin for me here not to have nachos.
So, thus, art house movies equals muffin movies. All right. Glad we got that out of the way. So, I think Artisan might be a way for them to start making certain movies feel prestigious.
Mm.
And so, like, I think The Goldfinch, which was based on a novel, had that imprint, and Knives Out had that imprint. And I think it's interesting because it isn't very, you know, low budget or very, like, very difficult or impenetrable movies that have that logo. So it's interesting to me as somebody that likes, you know, movies based on books, as somebody that likes upmarket, quote unquote, novel fiction. I like that they're doing something like that where it's like, okay, we're trying to make people like just dramatic movies that are mid-budget. And it's like, that seems like a way for them to market that way. There might be some, I might be being too optimistic in that sense. But anyway, I just noticed that for when I saw the ads for that, because they now also AMC had this weird thing where it does the logo before the trailer.
Oh.
And so it'll show different things, and it's like, it'll show the logo, I don't know if it's before or after the trailer, and then it'll show the date when it's coming out. Usually they would rely on the trailer to do that, but AMC has now like done that as a proprietary thing, is to say when the movie's coming out. But anyway, so Knives Out, yeah, it's on streaming on Amazon if you want to watch that. Oh, so talk a little bit about Altered Carbon.
Oh, yeah. So I don't know if we talked about it before or not.
I think we brought it up.
But I just started watching the next season, and I'm not quite sure how I feel about it yet, because the guy that plays Falcon, what's his name? Can you look him up for me? Because I feel bad that I don't remember anybody's names. is playing the new sleeve of the main character. In Altered Carbon, they have a way to move your consciousness from one body to another, and they call your body a sleeve now, because basically you could just get into whatever body you want to be in.
It's Anthony Mackie.
And he's a great actor. I love him, but I think of him as a good guy because he was, you know, Falcon.
Mm.
And so seeing him playing this kind of jerk character, I don't know if it's working for me yet. But he is still hanging out with the crazy AI that thinks he's Edgar Allan Poe, so I love that guy.
Oh.
And but I don't know if the books do this too, where they go off on like other stories that the character's doing. Because like the whole main, the first three, it was three seasons, two seasons, was one big long arc. So I'm not sure where they're going with it now, because it doesn't feel like the same kind of direction. Like he was solving a mystery in the first one. I don't know. Now he's just looking for somebody that's lost that I think should stay lost. So I don't know what's going on with that. But anyway, still fun, good, dark sci-fi, cyberpunky kind of stuff. So.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you say that, because that was a major problem that True Detective had to get over.
Yeah.
Because season one was universally praised. Season two was universally
despised.
But then three really brought it back. But that, from the outset, chose every season to be a self-contained story. It's a little interesting to me that you're saying, you know, for the first two seasons feels like a completed story, and now they're choosing for it to be more of an anthology type of thing.
Just let it have been done.
Right.
I don't like it when seasons overstay their welcome. Well, shows, excuse me, overstay their welcome.
But devs, we're just now getting into. let's explain that massive sigh. So, it's weird because we're kind of getting through this fact that like neither Melissa or I like this guy's philosophy
at all.
And his name is Alex Garland. He is the director of Ex Machina. And there were things within that movie that I was like, you're right, but sad. You're right, but this, like, you're basically saying that the condition of man is to be fatalist. But then with this show, it's getting deeper into the science. Devs starts out with a programmer who has figured out a way to create some kind of unguided process for evolution that it doesn't really explain in any terrible detail what it is. But once he does, I keep wanting to say Rain Wilson, but he's not Dwight.
No.
I keep going Rain Wilson, Ron Swanson, and then I keep blanking on what the actor's name is, but the guy that plays Ron Swanson in Parks and Recreation is a hipster CEO, Steve Jobs, self-insert person who it says, okay, so you've come up with this process. It's very good work. Would you like to join the devs team? Takes the guy to this temple-looking place and very magisterial. There's all these lights and it's very eerie. Tells him he can sit down at this computer and start whatever he likes at whatever job he wants. And whatever this guy, and so it's being a little fuzzy with time, I think, because the next thing that this guy decides to do is to try to sneak away with the code on his watch. And the CEO guy takes him aside and says, you know, you can't leave with that. But because you found out this code, I forgive you. And he gives him a hug. And then when the guy tries to run away, he has one of his goons suffocate him with a plastic bag. So if that sounds like your cup of tea.
And the point isn't necessarily that he's running off with the code. The point, and well, I mean, for the forgiveness part, he goes off in this whole big speech about everything being deterministic, and I knew you were going to do this anyway, so this is me forgiving you because I knew you were going to do this. Mm-hmm. But then the guy's like, yeah, well, I know what this code is doing. I'm out of here because this is insanity, and I can't believe this. And so, like, he... Yeah.
But
it was a very heavy thing to watch.
I'll say that what makes it a little less satisfying from a secular dramatic standpoint is that if your villain is Laplace's demon, where they know everything before it's going to happen, there would not be a show.
Okay. Yeah.
So it kind of is a weird thing, because if there is some access they have to the code of the universe, which it seems like they're suggesting, then there wouldn't be any dramatic tension because they're basically God. And like through allusions in the show, they are suggesting that.
Yeah.
That the villain is God, right? So I got some of that, those same vibes from watching Ex Machina. I was assuming that person didn't know half of the scientific things that are talked about in this show. So I'm hoping now that there is science behind it, that they're dramatically more sure that this person is actually a villain. Because like, if you take something like Watchmen, didn't seem like Alan Moore was 100% convinced Dr. Manhattan was a bad guy.
Right.
He just happened to be.
Yeah.
He was Superman in that story. Right. So I'm interested to see where it goes, because him being the villain gives me hope that they're trying to talk about what is now in the scientific realm being talked about as the information problem, where you can't explain consciousness with determinism. It doesn't correlate, you know. But nonetheless, it is very depressing and it is very dry. So if you're not a fan of very dry, like...
Yeah, nobody has any... It's like, imagine all of the actors are Keanu Reeves. And that's about the level of emotion you get.
Very good.
From the show.
A very good summation. On a brighter note, I was at Barnes & Noble today, and at the kiosk at their Starbucks, they had a discount. If you buy something from the cafe, you get a discount off their chosen curated book. And this time it was Irish Fairy and Folk Tales. I read the first poem that's just called The Fairies by William Allingham, and that was dope. That's all I'll say about that.
That was a what? And
I said it was dope.
Oh, it was dope.
That's what I'll say about that. And then The Priest's Supper by T. Crofton Croker is also really interesting because it starts off by talking about how there were people, like, as far as Christians and pagans are concerned, it starts off by talking about theories that, well, maybe the fairies are like angels. It's interesting as you read it to see the main character is actually, that's his concern, because he's trying to find a fish for the priest, and the fairies are stopping him from catching the fish. And so he has this, his own, as like a classic morality tale, he's wondering if it's like, do I talk to these things? Are they, do they want my soul? And they're like, we don't want your soul. We just want you to ask a question. But they're afraid of the priest. So there's an interesting thing. Because I think a lot of Irish tales are about religion versus the fairies.
Yeah.
So, so after the bump.
It's a mid-roll. You even waited for me to say it. After the mid-roll,
we're talking about Ted Chiang and more things.
More things.
Yes. So while we were watching Invisible Man, there was a I'm going to call it a pre-roll because we're on a roll.
No,
with the rolls.
Preview.
A preview for The Hunt, which was interesting to me because there was that series, The Purge, that started.
Right.
And to me, I thought this was a smarter reaction to that. Because seemingly what the theme of The Purge is, you know, everyone in America so uptight, they have all this aggression. Let's give them one day to just go hog wild and do whatever they want. But it's very fatalistic in the sense that it's like, there's not like an it's not like Hunger Games. Like, it's not like there's an uprising. It's just like, let's do a slasher movie every entry and have that be the excuse for why there's a slasher. This seems more like there is a very specific conspiracy and that they're parodying specifically, like, for example, like, so Hilary Swank is the villain, very obvious from the trailer that she's behind something.
Yes.
But she keeps saying things, and then the person's, she's like, it's almost like you think there's a, like, we just forced you all to go kill each other. And she's like, but you did.
Yeah.
And to me, that's making fun of not just one political person, but how politicians will say one thing
and be doing
and convince you that you're the crazy person when you figure out that they did something. So that to me is that it was actually very, like, there was an irony behind the joke. It wasn't just the silliness of, like, slasher movies where, like, oh, it's a rich person killing a poor person.
Right.
Like, let's you know, have gleefully react to that because it's a classist thing. It was actually portraying, like, different things. And then it actually feels like there's characters.
Yeah, that within is the true. Trailer. They do look like they're interesting characters, at least. It's not just a villain and weird disc going on.
Mm-hmm. So that makes me interested in seeing at least more trailers for it. It wouldn't be the first movie that I'd be interested in.
No, because the one that we saw previews for that I definitely want to see is Tenet.
Oh, yeah, boy.
That looks amazing.
Yeah. So it's another Nolan John.
Nolan John, is that what we call him now? Another Nolan joint?
Yes. I futz with Nolan up to hizzy.
I think Nolan needs to teach screenwriting classes if he isn't already. We should look into that because that man writes.
Well, I remember back in the day, I was certainly looking for books, and he didn't rush to get one out. Maybe by now, whatever publishers were either rejecting him or just waiting for him to be like Scorsese level or whatever, are letting him. But yeah, no, this is another one in the vein of Inception, where it's very magically real.
Yeah,
much more like, oh, I found a new word. It's morphism.
Morphism.
So apparently, like when we were watching Dr. Sleep, we have an episode of that too. I was referencing Jung a lot, but apparently, morphism is a step further.
Oh,
and that's what Adrian of Strip Club Lit, who I mentioned in a lot of the earlier episodes, was talking about The Shining as a very morphist book. So maybe there are things that whatever that is drew from Jung,
mm-hmm.
But it's much more concerned with where the consciousness is.
Oh.
And like what, like seems to be talking about it in much more like, almost like Christian Scientist terms.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about
Tenet.
Oh yeah.
Nolan.
So yeah. So I'm interested because it has to do with, the afterlife and,
time.
Yeah. And
weirdness.
Yeah. Because that's an interesting thing that there's different of his trademark time things, because his first movie where it's all backwards because the guy has amnesia,
mm-hmm.
so he's like trying to retrace his steps. That's one of the major themes in that. And then in Interstellar, obviously it's outside of time and space, and so he's messing with it that way. But even in The Prestige, it's very much.
Oh yeah,
the editing is very much
not
like
linear storytelling. Yeah.
So it's an interesting one. It's another entry in his style, more stylist, more auteur driven pictures. So I'm hype.
Yeah.
And John David Washington.
Yes.
More of him, please.
Yes, please. By all means.
I haven't seen, outside of, what was the one, I swear that there was something that I'd seen him, because I had watched a lot of interviews with him talking about what it was like growing up with Denzel and whether or not that had anything to do with him getting into movies and stuff. But I still haven't gotten a chance to see Black Klansman.
Oh, yeah.
But I do want to see that. But anyway, that's another one on my list. I thought you might want to talk a little bit about Exhalation.
Yes, I need to read more of it. But Ted Chiang is currently my favorite science fiction writer ever, ever, ever. And I was very happy to find that book because it has so far my favorite story by him, which is the Merchant and the Alchemist's Gate, I think is the title. Mm-hmm. It's a long title. But it's a beautifully written story about time travel and what you really would do if you had a chance to go back and fix things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just lovely. And then I've read some of the other stories in there. I'm in the middle of one now about creating AIs, and then they just currently actually put it into a robotic body to see what it would do.
Mm.
So, but they're like AI, they're pet AIs. They're like, they create like Tamagotchis basically, but like little virtual ones that you can, you know, take care of and whatever. And they actually put one into a body. So we'll see how that goes. but it's just, it continues to be amazing and beautiful and heart wrenching at the same time, which not a lot of science fiction manages to make you feel like that. You know, like it makes you think. So I'm used to a lot of good science fiction making you think or making you feel all like, you know, you're my hero, go save the world kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But not necessarily the deep down that hurts in my heart kind of stuff.
Mm.
And that's what he does.
Yeah. I would say, so I have been trudging through one of his that's called Hell is the Absence of God.
Mm-hmm.
I think more so because it's very emotional for me to read something where it seems like God is an abstract. Because it, as we've discussed, nobody does angels right.
Yes.
And so it's more focused on, like, plot-wise, it's more focused on these angels that have different visitations that they do. And whenever one visits, people, like, people's eyes disappear. And it's very absurd like that by, mm-hmm. like, referring to different miracles or tragedies that happen when an angel appears. And as if this is just the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
He's very good at that world building to where it feels like this is just how the world is. But that's also the weakness of it with me, because it's positioned. So I read in the back, he has cheat notes where he talks about like what inspired the story, why he wrote it, what his, you know, what his theme that he's actually going through, maybe not necessarily like definitively why he's writing it, but more along the lines of what inspired it. And with this, he talks about how he doesn't like Job because he thinks of it as if you think of it as a morality tale, which he does, why wasn't the point Job learns to persevere through his trials? Why is he just given another family, more livestock, more houses?
Mm.
And so because it's in that, it's interesting because, as you said, he is much more emotionality driven.
Yeah.
In a lot of his other stories. And it reads more like sci fantasy in the sense that it feels more like it's about a person's soul and their mind than it is about more of a traditional reading of it as like symbols. Because I found myself as I was reading it trying to like almost talk about like what this person's position is about like miracles and reading it more that way. And so it seemed uncharacteristic that it would be more about like the absurdity versus, because a lot of his other things, they feel more diegetic than this story does. But I would still recommend anybody to read Ted Chiang's stuff. This is just a particular story that is difficult for me. Before we go into what we might be reading and looking at for the next month, I thought that there was a Kickstarter that didn't give me my
your reward.
My reward, yeah. And it turns out that I just didn't check my messages on there because I got a PDF from one of them. And it's called The Williamsburg Shorts. And there's a borough in New York that called Williamsburg, where as a memoir of a principality as opposed to of an individual, it talks about the different people that have lived there, but in a comic strip, almost comic book form. It's much more avant-garde in the sense that they're not like gag comics, right? You know? But it does pit it as more of like a like this anthropological thing, because the first chapter was Hasidics versus hipsters, and so it's all about gentrification, mm-hmm. and how like these two groups like have to deal with each other, and so it's very funny, off the cuff. As I started, but I'll probably report a little bit more in that next episode. You were saying you might begrudgingly try more The Witcher.
Yeah, I was not terribly impressed with the first episode, but I might try some more, at least to get to the song part, because I like the bard guy, apparently.
Yeah.
I only saw like a flash of him for 2 seconds, but I already like the bard guy, so I might try it.
Well, But
if The Witcher continues to be stupid, I might not continue.
Yeah, because it's...
I don't like dumb heroes.
Yeah, that's the funny thing about it, is that it is a fantasy story, but as I've complained endlessly about fantasy, is that everybody seems to be obsessed with the assassin/hitman like version of right. like a hero. For the past umpteen years now. And, like, it used to be a knight errant, like somebody that has a quest. Like, there's a purpose for their existing. It's not a slasher with swords and sorcery.
Yeah.
So, it seems like that was what bothered me. Like, forget the times when he's doing things that are just stupid for you. Like, if you want to take somebody that's similar to him, Bond, right?
Yeah.
There is somebody that, like, is, like, a blunt instrument, as Madame Judi Dench would put it, and is the protagonist of this, like, kind of heightened reality, right? But then Bond knew that when the chicks were trying to kill him.
Yeah.
And this one did not.
Apparently does not. Like, how dumb can you be? Really?
So, anyway. Yeah, so we both, I don't know if we were in about this last episode, but it's worth revisiting. We are interested in, Fort Salem Motherland.
Oh, is that what that's called?
Yeah.
The military witch thing?
Just because we've been in this mood of, like, enchantment fiction, where, like, we've been discussing, like, how, this enchantment thing has seemingly been sucked out of a lot of fantasy. So I'm interested in that kind of returning. And it seems like witch mythology is a part of how that's returning,
mm-hmm.
because everybody trusts the old wives' tales.
Oh,
like,
sure.
That's like, if anybody in the room you're going to trust, it's the old lady that's making, you know, I mean, even though what she's stirring in the cauldron might be poisonous to the bad guys. Maybe for you, it would be a nice soup. Who knows?
I don't know where any of that came from, but okay. Sure.
And then I brought up Wendy last time, but it made you angry.
What did? What?
Remember, I brought up Wendy. I was talking about how there's that director that did the weird... that weird magical real thing with the Hurricane Katrina.
Oh, right.
So I didn't get to go out to see that, or Emma. Both still look good. I just didn't get a chance to see them. So
I'd go see Emma.
Oh, okay.
I like Emma.
Yeah, well, so I don't know if we went into that last time. This one seems like they're really stressing the... You know what? It seems like 90s Emma.
That was Clueless.
That seems like 90s Emma.
I think that's the fun of it, though. You can do it because it is supposed to be like that. She's a young, clueless teenager who's trying to think she knows everything and run her societal group and messes up and has to realize what she did and grow up a little. So, yeah, sure.
Clueless part two.
Clueless part
maybe,
two.
Maybe next time. Yeah, that's everything I had. Is there anything that's been floating around?
No, I have been in website land. Although, if anybody is also interested in following me on my journey to market my book, my first year having to market myself, and I don't know how well I will do with this, but I'm going to blog about my experiences on my website. I will also be putting up some short fiction and other things that you are able to see. So come to momtoast.com and enjoy.
I've been doing a show with Matt Krotz, creator of Kyrie, a comic that is taking Kickstarter and Indiegogo by storm. Bravo. Hip hip.
Hooray.
Oh, I'm going to give him a little, a bit of a copywriting pitch next time I talk to him, and saying that it is a sword and sandal and sorcery.
Sword and sandal and sorcery. I like it.
Set in 4th century North Africa. And we've been talking about a little bit of some of the stuff that is an extension kind of Inklings Month, well, on this show, where fantasy is a little bit of a entryway into how knowledge is not a scary thing. And sometimes, you know, the fairies might corner you in a dark wood to tell you what you need to know. And that's cool. You know, it's not a Promethean experience, right? You're not going to melt if you fly too close to the sun.
That was mixing way too many things in the same breath.
See, this is the thing. It intimidates people to think about what these things mean. And that's kind of what pains me when
So there's people that can turn that off in their brains? How do you do that? You have to write to me and tell me how you can turn off the part of your brain that goes, that just thinks about what all those things mean. Because I do that all the time. Mm. It won't shut up.
Right. But that to me is a feature, not a bug. And there are a lot of people that in school, when they are introduced to really good literature, they're like, oh no, this hurts. I don't want any of this. And then they don't read for decades.
For 10 years. And then they're like, oh, I guess I should do one of these Kindle things. And they start reading again.
So, but it gave me a lot of hope to see somebody that was doing a historical fiction work.
Yeah.
That was not dry. It was not lifeless.
It's not a bodice ripper.
Yeah. It's really well researched. It has a lot of meaning, but it's also a heck of a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So, and that's kind of what I'm trying to do with mysteries set in the, in more of a modern setting, and modern in the academic sense of the word, post like 50s to 70s. And like, I was personally inspired by a lot of the exploitation movies and a lot of I guess I should go back to the 20s, because a lot of detective stuff, there's different, like when we were watching Knives Out, I was like, this totally looks like a Starsky and Hutch thing that like mixes a lot of the mystery tropes, but definitely has a sense of style and a sense of substance. So yeah, if you're interested, we have a show, Strider Talk, that's every Monday at 7. Eastern Standard Time. And we just talk about stories, and we talk about how we can get good stories to people. Our motto is, what is it?
All that is gold does not glow. No, you have the other one. Not all those who wander are lost.
Right. Well, no, that's our culture's thing.
Oh, sorry. See?
It's,
that's the only one I know.
I'll look it up.
Got his own motto.
I have it on our Twitter.
How do you forget your own motto? What's a motto?
What's a motto with you? uncommon good for the common man.
There you go.
Yeah, because that it as a writer, I tend to think of it as, you know, you only pass knowledge through words. And so a comic writer knows that you can do it a multitude of ways. Art to me is a good way of tapping into that good that is everywhere, right? So yeah, that's kind of our mission statement. We're trying to talk about how we can work on projects together to do more really good quality writing and get that out to the masses. He's already doing it with Kyrie, and he's doing a really good job of advocating for that type of stuff in different shows all across YouTube. Recently, he was on Brian Ball's, or no, he had Brian Ball on his channel. So if you want to check out Matt Kratz, you can find out, you know, what they were talking about, mostly around crowdfunding and whatnot. But yeah, I'm excited about what we're doing, and I'm excited what Misha's up to. That's another thing. You don't get to call her that.
No, only he gets to call me Misha.
But yeah, no, I'm
and
excited.
Only I get to call him John Boy.
Oh.
So there.
And well, the Waltons, are they still around? Anyway.
No.
All right.
We gotta go.
Talk to you more next time. And thanks for listening.
Bye.